Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. This is L.A. Steele, and glad you're with us. Tonight, I'm going to change directions a little bit. Not every day that a person comes out with a brand new book, and I just got it this week. It just was released this week, and it's called Naked at the Mic, The Survival of the Liberal in a Time of Peril. And the book I'll read the back of the book as to kind of explains what the book is about. Naked at the Mic is a bold defense of liberalism that chronicles the demise and resurgence of liberalism in America since 2000. Is an autobiographical account of the establishment and survival of a commercially broadcasted liberal talk radio show during one of the most politically conservative periods in American history. The span of research for this book includes thousands of archived news articles published from alternative and mainstream sources since 2000 and hundreds of broadcasted interviews from the L.A. Steele Show. Guests interviewed have ranged in views from presidential candidate Ralph Nader, peace activist Cindy Sheehan, Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin, civil rights activist Jesse Jackson, former U.S. attorney Ramsey Clark, defense attorney for Saddam Hussein, John McManus, president of the John Birch Society, actor Ed Asner, and hundreds of well-known authors, journalists, activists, and politicians. Part two of this book, entitled Essays and Insights, includes 166 selected essays and insights chosen from over 500 published online articles from the author's website, lasteelshow.org. And the subjects are based on some of the most significant national and international events and personalities from 2000 to 2009. A lot of people know that I run this show, but a lot of them don't realize what I've done over the time. Lila and I have done a tremendous amount of work on television, radio, and sponsored events, and campaign manager for Ed Cole and running for governor. But we've also done, I filmed and directed and produced 12 documentaries, full-length documentaries, and I've done over 400 programs for television. I just read it here that I founded the Steele Wood Media Company in 1999, produced and directed over 400 television programs for the weekly series on Connecticut cable television. A producer and host of the L.A. Steele Talk radio show on WQQQ 103.3 FM and WQQQ.com since 2003. The L.A. Steele Talk radio show is one of the longest-running, independently produced, commercially broadcasted liberal talk shows in America. I'm a lecturer and sponsor guest forums and panel discussions on controversial topics. I have produced and directed 10 feature documentaries, which include the Connecticut Coalition Against Millstone 2001, 2002 Connecticut State Democratic Convention, the 118 2003 DC anti-war rally, and the 924 2005 Washington DC anti-war rally. And a teaching by Buddhist patriarch Sakya Trisen, the Skatiko Tribal Nation Speaks Out, World Peace Festival 2000 and 2001, One World Fair, and the 911 Omission Commission. I've established the L.A. Steele Show .org website in 2004, the L.A. Steele Weekly Internet Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, 2006, and I now have over 450, almost 500 audio programs that are available online archives at on this station on blogtalkradio.com/LASteeleShow.org. and thought that I should read that. But that's essentially my background in a nutshell. And the book involves the book contains 16 chapters and 166 essays. The essays are broken down into six categories. There are national politics, international politics, patriotism, satire, mainstream media, and metaphysics. What I did with this book is the publication date of each essay, as I posted it on my website, is printed next to each title to note the historical perspective. And the original works are available on the LASteelShow.org public archives, in the archives. And that's what we got here. I wanted to start with a couple of essays. I wanted to read a few essays tonight from the book. And rather difficult to know where to start, and I was thinking of probably starting at the beginning, working my way, and read a one or two essays tonight from each segment. They're not very long, you know, but they're between one and two or three pages long, so I can get a few of them in tonight. But I felt it was important to read them, since people don't realize that that's what's in the book, and unless they read the cover. The back cover, and it's my job to try to make people understand what's there. Now, this book, this first is, I got 81 essays in the national politics category, and I have broken down, let me just see here, I broke it down by the numbers. I actually have a title, the numbers to the of the essays, 81 in a national politics category. There's 19 essays in the international politics, I have 26 essays in on satire, political satire, and social satire, mainstream media, and 9 essays. Patriotism, 11 essays and insights. I have 11 different essays that I wrote on patriotism. And metaphysics, I have 20 essays on that. And of course, I have a short afterword on this. But essentially, this entails 166 essays. And I'm going to start off with the very first, since it starts the segment, and it's called Bushism. And I wrote this in January 5th, 2005. This is regarding, of course, Bush and the doctrines that he had. Bushism. There is in a society that rests upon industry the constant danger of barbarism. That was a quote by Theodore Roosevelt. The world has endured feudalism, communism, fascism, racism, socialism, Stalinism, Catholicism, Protestantism, Zionism, radicalism, conservatism, and countless other isms. But now the world must endure the most ominous and globally threatening philosophy of world domination ever conceived, and the driving force behind a military and madman that could destroy the entire planet. Again, I wrote this in 05 when Bush was still in office. The present U.S. military industrial complex is created under the false flag by the people of the United States that it would preserve, protect, and defend to lasting peace and prosperity and defense from our foreign enemies. We have been deceived by corrupt militaristic leaders who have unleashed the most horrific military force never before witnessed on the planet. The great people of the United States are beginning to realize their betrayal by their present government and are now identifying the treasonous cowards in their Congress and Senate who have cowered to G.W. Bush and oil and defense industry lobbyists. As the United States spins into economic ruin, G.W. Bush and our corrupt and cowardly Congress passed a tax bill that gave each voting member of Congress a minimum of a $90,000 tax refund. All members of the House and Senate are in the 1% income bracket, while they have disseminated our public education system, welfare system, Social Security, and Medicare, and diverted untold billions of dollars, destroying artificial enemies to distract our attention while they shred the Constitution that protects our sacred rights as a free people. Millions of Americans have and are protesting their horrid, selected, and fraudulently elected administration, and yet are ignored by the corporate-owned and corporate-controlled media and our cowardly, corrupt Congress. Our cities and airports have been seized by our military and police, who are paid by our tax dollars to surveillance, wiretap, and harass each and every citizen based solely upon the agents' or officers' individual discretion and judgment as to who they might consider as suspicious. Our young soldiers have been sent to fight on battlegrounds around the world and must defend themselves from the hatred of United States enemies. Those enemies created by the blundering, imperialistic, and inept policies of our own incompetent leaders. Our soldiers must try to believe that they are placing their lives in jeopardy for the good of their country, while at the same time they know they are only cannon fodder for the artillery of the international plutocracy of arms dealers and munitions manufacturers and financiers that create wars to control the world's economies or bring into compliance leaders of countries who refuse to allow them to plunder the wealth, pride, and natural resources of their country. Our young men and women in military are asked to face death or torture at the immediate orders of a mad, cowardly, fraudulently elected president who himself went AWOL, joined his questionable service in the Air National Guard. The following 10 terms and their definitions are direct from Webster's Unabridged Dictionary. They are being used in this article to identify and define each philosophical, political, and psychological concept that influenced and created the most rapidly spreading, universally feared, psycho-political, economic plague ever unleashed on the human race, Bushism. Number one, barbarism. Any art or performance that runs counter to prevailing standards of good taste or what is intellectually or artistically sound or correct. Backwardness, the practice or display of barbarian acts, attributes, attitudes, and ideas of barbarous cruelty or brutality. Now these are from Webster's Dictionary. Mammonism, riches regarded as an object of worship and greedy pursuit, wealth or material gain as evil deified. Plutocracy, government by the wealthy, a controlling class of rich men. Totalitarianism, of or relating to a political regime based on subordination of the individual to the state and the strict control of all aspects of life and productive capacity of the nation, especially by coercive measures as censorship and terrorism. Fascism, a philosophy or system of government that advocates or exercises a dictatorship of the extreme right, typically through the merging of state and business leaders, together with an ideology of belligerent nationalism. Nationalism, excessive, narrow, or jingoistic patriotism, chauvinism, the doctrine that national interests, security, etc., are more important than international considerations. Imperialism, imperial government or authority, the policy and practice of forming and maintaining an empire in seeking to control raw materials and world markets by the conquest of other countries, the establishment of colonies, etc., the policy and practice of seeking to dominate the economic and political affairs of underdeveloped areas or weaker countries. Conservatism, a political viewpoint supporting tradition and established institutions and preferring gradual development to abrupt change, tendency to prefer an existing situation or way and to be suspicious of change. Republicanism, other relating to or constituting a political party in the U.S., usually associated with business, financial, or some agricultural interest and favoring a restricted governmental role in social and economic life. And finally, insanity. Any form or degree of mental derangement or unsoundness of mind, permanent or temporary, that makes a person incapable of what is regarded legally as normal, rational conduct or judgment. It usually implies a need for hospitalization, great folly, extreme senselessness. And that is Bushism. Some of you who are politically astute or aware may have heard of CPAC. They had their meeting down in D.C. in February of this year, last month, and there was a lot of hoopla. What CPAC is the Conservative Political Action Conference, and this article was written, and I wrote it in January 04. And it's called An Invitation to Hell. And this was the CPAC. Is a Conservative Political Action Committee, and the name of it is An Invitation to Hell. CPAC is a Conservative Political Action Conference, which is an annual convention of grassroots conservative activists and broadcasters held in February at the Ronald Reagan Building in D.C. To my great surprise, I received an invitation to attend the conference and interview some or many of the conservative pundits and political celebrities who will be gathered there. At first, I thought the letter was a joke by one of my listeners, until I decided to call the media coordinator to confirm my invitation and ask if they were aware that I was a liberal talk show host. She laughed and said, "Yes, we knew you were a liberal show, but we decided to invite liberal talk show hosts to this convention to raise the level of interest. In fact, Al Franken is going to debate G. Gordon Liddy." I realized at that moment that either I was being sucked into a dare or that CPAC was openly offering liberals a forum, or at least a microphone, to hear what we might have to say. Right. I was still a little stunned to find out that my invitation wasn't a mistake and that I was being given the chance to interview and listen to some of the top pundits and conservative thinkers in the country. Wow. I thought, what a great opportunity for a small radio station, liberal talk show host, to go toe-to-toe with some of the greatest blunderheads in the world. I spoke to a few friends and my station manager, and all said it was a great opportunity and chance to get some real meaningful discussions with the right and far right. I thought this was a good idea until I looked up the conference agenda. Novak debates Donaldson, speakers Ann Coulter, Mitch McConnell, etc., etc., blah, 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 and the list got worse and worse. Then we were to celebrate with the young Americans at a grand Ronald Reagan banquet. I was certain I could never survive a minute in that hell without one of Dante's divine guides. Then I thought, what the hell was I thinking? Was I for one minute thinking that I could possibly get an interview with any one of these conservative clones of merit? Me, Mr. Liberal? This is all a grand setup to probably screw me and any other poor sucker liberal talk show host into the woodwork. Not only was the list of attendees less than stellar, Last year, they had Dick Cheney. It appeared that the list of conservative pundits and politicos attendant this year were dramatically downgraded to C-list celebs and politicians. This was probably why they invited the liberal media. I realized that my going to this conference could only result into my descent into a liberal's hell. 3 days of droning Christian conservatives praying for G.W. Bush and the rise of theocratic government in the U.S. would warp my mind into ideas of becoming a suicide bomber. I foresaw my discomfort levels rising to levels of unbearable pain and agony, tantamount to greater torture than inflicted on prisoners at Abu Ghraib. What a nightmare. I thought of trying to phrase a non-insulting question or trying desperately not to blur it out in anger or scream or why or how. I knew the answer I received, if any, would make less sense than my own question as I descended deeper into conservative madness, deeper into hell, nearing the fiery furnace of the comprehension of Christian, right-wing, conservative, young American, neocon, Bushism. Ah! I was shocked into realizing there is much to be said about preaching to the choir, staying within your realm of understanding, and not tempt madness. Liberalism is not madness, nor is it a disease, as so many crackpot Christian neocon nutters like to declare it to be. Liberalism is the belief in the best of man. Conservatism is the belief in the worst of man. These are the direct meanings from Webster's Dictionary. That was my experience about 6 years ago now. But I first got invited to go to CPAC. But anyway, what I was going to the next article I'd like to read is again from National Politics, and I many of you know Howard Dean. I've heard of Howard Dean, and if you haven't, well, he's been kind of out of the limelight for a while now, but he was a front runner back in 2004 until Kerry somehow got the nomination for president. But I was so disgusted by Howard Dean after the election because when I realized that he was no longer, he professed to be a maverick and a, you know, anti-war liberal, and you know, he had a lot of fight, and he had come out against Bush, and he hated Bush's policies, and so on. And at that time, I agreed. I supported him up until, of course, his campaign went, it exploded and imploded, I should say, after the New Hampshire primary with a great yell and scream and that we remember. But really, that, you know, it took me a while, a couple of months actually, to figure out what had happened. And then once Dean became the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, everything fell into place and I realized what he was all about. Howard Dean, the Judas Goat. This was written January 12, 2005. When a herd of sheared sheep are led into a slaughterhouse, they are led by a trained goat aptly named the Judas Goat. The goat leads the sheep into the slaughterhouse and takes a sharp right turn as the sheep continue to follow each other toward the left into holding pens, where their throats are cut and they are hoisted upon meat hooks upside down and their blood drains into large containers. Then the sheep are gutted, their entrails collected and sorted. Their hides are skinned from the carcasses, and then the carcasses are cleaned and washed down and placed on meat racks and hooks in coolers until they are packaged or shipped whole to retail outlets, where they are cut into palatable pieces by the local butcher and sold to the public. Howard Dean was the Judas Goat of the American peace movement. This mindless robot of Democratic Party machine of the Democratic Party machine is a Yale graduate and skull and bones wannabe, rich son of a wealthy Republican stock baron. He became a doctor after he decided stockbroking wasn't his thing. Also, medicine and surgery could rationalize his detachment to the human race, which served him well in politics. Howard Dean teamed up with Joe Chuppie, and together they created the Dean machine to herd the left-wing voters away from Ralph Nader and destroy the American peace movement. When Dean and Chuppie dropped their pants in Iowa and mooned the world, it was the perfect opportunity to destroy their candidacy, and they did. Kerry and the other faux Democratic candidates were all given cue cards and roles to play once the herd of sheared sheep, were headed into the doors of the Democratic slaughterhouse. Dean took a right turn and destroyed his own candidacy, but do not feel pity for the Judas goat. He and his team mate Joe Chuppie got $50 million for the betrayal of the peace movement and the heart of the American liberal conscience. The Chuppie money machine took over $90 million for the Dean campaign from the small donations of millions of Americans who hated Bush and the Iraq War. All that was counted for was $40 million, which at the time of Dean's concession was more money than any other candidate had spent or received. Chuppie paid himself and his advertising firm $10 million and said the rest was paid out in payroll and travel expenses. Under current election laws, all money collected by a candidate can be kept by the candidate and spent according to the candidate's wishes. That Dean Internet money machine was then used by John Kerry, and even old Joe Lieberwurm got into the picture, firing his campaign manager early in the campaign because she would not let him take so much money out of the campaign coffers for personal use. Lieberwurm paid his children all six-figure salaries while he ran for press, knowing he didn't have a chance in hell of winning, but knowing he had a great excuse to be absent from the Senate and take $10 million in the process, while running around the country shaking hands and kissing babies. Hell, I'd do that for $10 million. The honest and real liberals and peacemakers of this country believed in Howard Dean's words and the possibility of beating Bush in a fair campaign. Dean had no real ability other than that of a crooked politician. Where is his insane scream now against the vast election fraud in the 2004 election? Where is the mighty Howard Dean now, the Democrats' phallic symbol on Viagra, the Judas goat, and the new chairman of the DNC? Rather than go into great history, because this is really kind of a current history Wolf deals a lot with current history. And I say current, I mean in the last 10 years. And it explains the, and as a liberal, these are all published on my website over the last 10 years, or last since 2004, actually. And that's where that goes. I've got 81 of these articles just in national politics alone, but I wanted to skip over a few and get into things that you may not have heard about, and we'll go there in a minute. This one I would like to read tonight because it says a lot. This is basically an autobiography, this book, in a lot of ways, but it's also a book about historical fact and presidential campaigns and, the Bush administration. And it has a lot. I have a chapter on environmentalism, a chapter on the media, and I've got, it just covers the gamut of political thought, the mainstream media, international politics. It covers Palestine. I talk about Palestine. I talk about Israel, and I talk about Iran and Russia and a lot of statements on that. All that's new and happening now, everything is happening now that I predicted would, and years ago, and in this book, and I'm very proud that I was on the right track. I've been right. That's why my program has stayed on the air, and why I have over 50,000 internet listeners, and why my and I believe because we're speaking truth, and in some ways even prophetic truth, because it what we predicted back then that would happen is happening now. I wrote this article in retrospect in 2007, okay, in February 15th, actually, 2007. That's when I posted it. It's called How I Lost My Political Virginity. And it was kind of inspired by a statement by a publicist that actually I have her as chapter 12 in this book. But what she had stated to me was how she lost her political virginity after the 2004 election. Eileen was very much involved in the voter rights movement and so on. And she was just totally disgusted by what happened in the concession by Kerry and them not counting the votes and so on. And, I mean, over 3 million votes weren't counted in that election, Democratic votes. So Kerry would have won, but Kerry conceded quickly and didn't contest. But anyway, that's another story in the book. This particular one is an essay that's called How I Lost My Political Virginity. I was politically seduced in 2000. That was the year I decided to film a documentary on the Nader-Leduc campaign for president from a personal perspective. Ralph Nader was giving a campaign speech in his hometown of Winsted, Connecticut, which was the first speech I recorded. I was surprised by the excitement at that event. A lady enthusiastically asked me if she could order a copy of the program. She felt that it would be a historic event her children and grandchildren should see. Ralph Nader spoke seriously and humbly to his hometown people. He named many who attended in his speech and gave his thanks for their support of his presidential campaign. His mother, sister, and niece sat in the front row. I had two camera angles set up to pan the crowd. My cameraman had his camera focused directly on Nader. Joe was wearing a black leather jacket with an American flag on the back and wore a pair of American flag sneakers. He was a blue-collar Republican. That was my cameraman. And I did a single camera shot on Nader and the hand signer next to him for the hearing impaired. It was a crazy shoot. I took several weeks to edit, and I learned several important lessons by filming that documentary, partly because it was my first, and secondly because I had never been as enthused by a political campaign. I offered my services as a videographer to provide local access cable coverage of each event so that he could be seen throughout the state of Connecticut. I didn't get a chance to interview Nader due to time restraints. He insulted me and my crew by telling me to watch the Charlie Rose show that he was filming that afternoon in New York City. He was obviously infatuated and flustered by all the attention, and his nephew, who was his handler, was extremely rude. That was the only meeting I had with Ralph Nader until after the election, when no one else wanted to talk to him. Ralph Nader and Winona LaDuke carried the flame of hope for a third-party presidential candidacy. Now that I contemplate the idea, I am still excited by the possibility, but I also know that it is virtually impossible to crash the private two-party gluttonous banquet of power. Third parties are always considered aggressive and belligerent beggars for power, pounding at the front door of the U.S. Capitol building. It is less tiring for me to write and produce programs as I do to denounce and question the power gluttons. Unpaid and unpaid political work is time and mind-consuming and extremely frustrating, especially when you're working for a political long shot. No serious gambler would have invested a dime in the Nader campaign unless it was to knock out Gore. I learned the hard way that the system is definitely rigged. However, I'll always be grateful to Ralph Nader and Winona LaDuke for attempting the impossible and giving hope to the politically hopeless. I remember very well the excitement that surrounded the Nader-LaDuke campaign in 2000. I filmed three of Ralph Nader's speeches in three unique locations. I sent the Nader campaign a copy of the program as my donation to the campaign to use in commercials or handouts and with donations. I was neither contacted by the Nader campaign or given acknowledgement that they received the program. This arrogance bothered me, but I believe it was more disorganization to blame. The Nader campaign was in chaos. No one thought Nader's message would take off the way it did. And depending on poor and cheap lefties to fund and operate a presidential campaign was doomed to begin with. But this is always the fate of idealistic, nonviolent revolutions against a well-funded and entrenched establishment. It is questionable that the real motives of Ralph Nader were. I have always been curious to know how many Republicans donated to the Nader campaign. I like to believe Nader's campaign was a noble cause. Nader never demanded a voter count in 2000. Many of Nader's votes around the country were not counted, and evidence came forth that some Nader votes were counted as core votes in the hotly contested states. The war against the two-party system hurt the Democrats greatly. Nader exposed the blatant hypocrisy of the establishment liberals. Losing the election and wounding the Democrats was worth it. To keep Lieberman away, further away than a heartbeat from the White House. Lieberman's treason is well exposed now. No one but a few Connecticut Republican loyalists have any regard for Lieberman. 2000 was still a glorious time in U.S. politics. We proved the power of populist movement to disrupt the complacency of the power elite. The Nader campaign exposed the vulnerable underbelly of the two-party beast. It exposed the desperate lack of leadership in the Democratic Party. It proved to the American voter that the Democrats could not fight for and win the presidency, even when they had already won. The election revealed to the world the fraudulent voting practices of the world's foremost model of representative government. In the U.S., is the U.S. any better for it? Only history will tell if the U.S. will recuperate from the Bush assault on the Constitution and the war with Iraq and Afghanistan. As a politically devirginated liberal, I hope for a brighter future and continue to fight the best I can with the tools I have. I want to prevent the further erosion of the vision of an ideal United States. I feel as an American that I must pass the vision on to future generations. It is the duty of parental and elderly Americans to keep the hope of our country in the hearts and minds of our children. They must be taught their own collective power and responsibility and the priceless value of preserving their constitutional rights and freedoms. They must be able to understand that their nation one day will call upon one of them to be the President of the United States. In 2000, the Nader-LaDuke campaign exploded, and by 2004, Winona LaDuke was forgotten. Nader's message in 2004 was taken seriously for a while, until his chaotic war with the Democrats became his downfall. There were so many Nader-LaDuke supporters in 2000 that I proudly placed a Nader-LaDuke bumper sticker on my 1987 red Toyota pickup truck. My red truck was street legal and had rusty chrome bumpers. It had just the right look and feel for a Nader-LaDuke supporter. The Nader-LaDuke banner conveniently covered the worst rust spots on the chrome bumper of the LA Steel political status symbol. I'm much more sensible in 2007. I totaled the red pickup truck in 2001 and have had two newer vehicles since, but neither of them were pickup trucks. I no longer have a secret hope when I relate to politics. The hungover rage of our elections and the 911 enemy were two powerful unleashed distractions. In 2001, a generation was reminded of the ideals they should believe in. A generation was branded with the mark of patriot or traitor, as we are forced to look upon our reflected image against the charred metal and crumbled stone in the flames of the World Trade Center. We were deceived. America was deceived by its own complacency and indifference to those who govern the United States and the media's complicity in the cover-up of the Bush administration's conspiracy and treason. A third party should run again, this time with the undivided support of every American who is truly committed to restoring America's greatness. This time we must support a great leader who is invulnerable to his own vanity. We must find a leader who understands his responsibility to all who placed on him the hope of their future and the future of their nation. I am a Leduc. I am a Nader Leduc idealist. I am from the generation of established anti-establishment liberals. An entire generation of idealists lost their political virginity in 2000. We were raped by the two-party beast and demonized by the conservative media. Liberalism became a curse word in America. Liberals were screamed at, abused, threatened, and humiliated by 3,000 conservative talk show hosts who created a papier-mâché corpse of liberalism and carried it to the funeral pyre, burned it in effigy with carnival revelry as they mocked all liberal leaders and martyrs. The Bushites worshipped the tyrannical deceit and corruption that brought about their rule of, their rule of war, bigotry, and ignorance. Bushites blatantly support and display their own papier-mâché ruler and promote him as a shining example of stupidity and Republican right-wing virtues. Liberals must uphold our values of liberalism again, but we must be careful. We must identify our enemies of Bushism, fascism, socialism, communism, anarchy, neoconism, imperialism, and corporatism. We must indelibly be aware of the true meaning of liberalism, which is the belief that humanity is inherently good. Liberalism must survive to restore and preserve the spirit and integrity of the United States. Americans must learn and believe that righteousness and justice for all are their sacred and everlasting rights. And that's how I lost my political virginity. I'm going to step over. We have another 20 minutes or so, and I'd like to get into my some of the international essays. I wrote this during the Lebanese-Palestinian war, and I was absolutely frustrated, absolutely shocked at how Lebanon could be destroyed and how the Palestinians could be brutally murdered in a cold-blooded genocide. And allowed by, and then Bush, in his arrogance and ignorance, would grin and say nothing and support Israel. And I wrote this in 2006, in June 19th, 2006. And it says, if I were a Palestinian, I would be mad as hell. If I was a Palestinian, I would be in full support of Hamas. If I were a Palestinian, I would want the destruction of Israel. If I were a Palestinian, I would want the destruction of all who ignore my people. If I were a Palestinian, I would be arming myself and wanting to kill any Israeli who tried to harm me or my family. If I were a Palestinian, I would be an armed freedom fighter. If I were a Palestinian, I would be one of the angriest people in the world. It is probably better for the Palestinians that I am not a Palestinian. I might put them in more trouble than they are in now. As an American who has spoken to Palestinians of their occupation, I understand their plight to the extent that I can without living under Israeli occupation. As an American, I am ashamed by my government's action against the Palestinians. As an American, I am disgusted by the elected officials who authorize sanctions and ignore Israeli violence against Palestine. I am ashamed and disgusted by the apathy of the American people over the plight of the Palestinian people. Americans went to war with Iraq supposedly to free it from a genocidal dictator, but we support a genocidal Israeli government. Why would anyone or any government support the murderous actions of the Israeli government against the Palestinians? Who are these people in charge of American foreign policy? Who are these wicked international terrorists and mass murderers who have stolen Palestine from the Palestinians and now are conducting genocide of the Palestinian people? Who are these murderous Zionists? Who are these murderous Americans in our White House and Congress? Who are the Jewish lobbyists that bribe and blackmail the United States Congress to support the Israeli genocide against the Palestinians? If I were a Palestinian, I would be praying to whatever God I knew. If I were an Israeli, I would be fearing the God of the Palestinians, for even the most apathetic God, goaded and offended enough, will rise and place courage and commitment and faith in their people to conquer their oppressors. If I were an Israeli, I would fear the vengeance of the Palestinians' God. If I were a Palestinian, I would be listening for my God's voice. If I were a Palestinian, I would be spreading my God's voice to my people. If I were a Palestinian, I would organize all righteous Palestinians to march against Israel in full force of their remaining millions, at first in a peaceful march into Israel to demand our rights and end the occupation. If that did not work and many of my people were killed by the Israelis, then I would organize all with rifles and guns and hand grenades and attack Israel with all my forces of remaining millions until either they or we were the victors. This would be a just fight. This would be a worthy battle. This would be a godly, driven, faith-driven, furious battle for the sanctity of the Palestinian right to life and liberty. If all Palestinians were willing to be martyred for their right to exist, then the world would be in awe of the magnificence of these people. Israel would then become the scourge of the earth, hated and despised by all people for their extermination of the Palestinians. If I were a Palestinian, would I be willing to sacrifice my life for the freedom and dignity of my people and myself? If I were a Palestinian, would I be willing to die by an Israeli bullet or bomb? If I saw my family or neighbors slaughtered before my eyes, would I be willing to fight for their dignity and right to life and vow vengeance to their murderers? As an American, I would be willing to do the same for another American. Would I do so for a Palestinian? If I were pushed to that limit, yes, I am sure that I would. Everyone must come to this reality in their life. We must all justify our convictions and face ourselves in some time in our lives. We must face up to the awful truth of someone's hatred against us, either because of our race, our religion, or our nationality. The hatred is there. It exists. Will that hatred against us consume us with fear or give us the strength and courage to defend ourselves against those who willfully seek our destruction? This is why countries have militaries, because they understand the possible threat to their nation and society. But the Palestinians have no military, and Palestine is an occupied nation, occupied and enslaved by the Israeli government and Israel's closest ally, the United States. Forgiveness of a wicked enemy is total folly. As you kneel and pray for their forgiveness, they kill your family and friends and then you. It is better to stand before your murderers and fight to the death. I would rather die knowing that my murderer was not dead, was also dead, or will be disabled throughout life from my gun or knife or grenade, and that my enemy is haunted by his limbless horror throughout the remainder of his life. Thou shalt not kill is a forbidden commandment by the Israelis and by their Christian allies in the United States. Do unto others before they do unto you is the George W. Bush doctrine of preemptive strike. Do unto others as others have done unto you is the Israeli golden rule. Do unto others to defend yourself is the Palestinian golden rule. This is madness or insanity, you might be thinking. It is not. It is simple reality. If faced with one's own annihilation, would we accept it willingly and welcome it, or would we fight until we had no life left in us and make our memory last in legends? This is the ultimate human question. Should we live and die without the right to exist freely as human beings? Or should we fight to the death all who deny us our basic human rights? The great American statesman Patrick Henry said, "Give me liberty or give me death." I always admired that statement. Many great Americans put their lives at risk and died for freedom against occupation. If you were a Palestinian, what would you do? I have one more on that issue that I'd like to read tonight before we run out of time. Or maybe I won't. I think I have others in there, and I think it's important. I have one called Ahmadinejad in favor of him. Ahmadinejad's the man. But I thought I'd end tonight with a one of my satirical essays, and I think you'll get a kick out of it. It's kind of fun. Find it here. Okay. The next essay I'm going to read, I wrote a number of satirical essays for the on the website during the Republican Democratic conventions and so on over the several many years. But there's one here if I can find it. It's called Presidential Political Pornography, and regarding the last conventions, and I'm trying to find it here. I can't seem to locate it. Here it is. I've got enough time. It's not a very long one, and probably go to another one after. Presidential Political Pornography. I wrote this on September 4th, 2008. Is any curious, this is after I watched the Republican and Democratic conventions. As any curious American male who writes political commentary and satire, I had to watch last night's premier performer, Sarah Palin, perform oratory sex on a 72-year-old man and arouse 4,000 erectile dysfunctional and menopausal Republican delegates. Unlike Hillary Clinton, who is into bondage and submissive sex with a 46-year-old black political idol, and the Democratic Convention's premier lap dancer, Hillary Clinton, gave a less than convincing performance when she deep-throated her support for Obama, as she painfully bent over the microphone in front of the entire New York delegation. Hillary heavily gasped into the deep breath and spoke in a loud, deep voice, "I nominate Barack Obama for Democratic presidential nominee." As an interested observer of political punishment, I was impressed until she said again, "I nominate Barack Obama for the Democratic presidential nominee." Crowd cheered as if they had I just publicly stoned and raped Hillary into submission. It was a sad but erotic moment in presidential politics. Last night's Republican convention was a delight in the political to a political porn aficionado. The warm-up speaker to Sarah Palin's premier performance was none other than cross-dressing bisexual knighted by the Queen of England, former Republican presidential contender, lover of John McCain, Mayor 911 Rudy Giuliani. Rudy gave a tight-lipped speech about the virtues of John McCain and his manly virility as a great hero and leader and the oldest presidential candidate in history. Sarah Palin, at the young age of pre-marriage to the first dude of Alaska, began her political porn career by winning the Miss Congeniality Award for Miss Alaska. 20-something years later, she has grown into a spitfire of a woman, ready to claw, screech, and wink her way to the presidency of the United States. This chick is hot. I must applaud Sarah Palin's premier performance. Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton have made the 2008 presidential elections fun. Together, they have created the institution of political pornography and have excited middle-aged Democratic and Republican Americans as no other has ever done before in U.S. political convention history. CNN showed convention security agents escorting a middle-aged woman out of the convention hall as she shouted obscenities at Sarah and the Republican delegates and held her hand up in a peace sign as the security officers grabbed her by the arm and pushed her up the stairs. I think Sarah could have won that catfight. Yes. I got a few others. I got 166 of them in here, guys, and I. Maybe I'll end on a patriotic note. My section, I have a full section of 20 essays there, so on patriotism. Let me end with this essay called The Radical Soul. This, I wrote this on December 4th, 2004. Some things make a radical radical. I haven't identified that certain attribute or detriment to the radical character yet. As I keep seeing more injustice and abuse of power and starving, crippled, homeless misery of millions of people around the planet, I get angry and feel the need to do something about correcting the wrongs I see. I have discovered that it is a whisper from the soul that stirs me. A silent surge of emotion creates a tear or makes me angry enough to swear at the television news commentator or videotape sound bites by George W. Bush or Tom DeLay or Bill Frist or John Kerry or Joe Lieberman and virtually every American politician. I think radicals are born, not made. I think a radical has always been a radical in his worldview. He or she cannot accept things that aren't just or are hurtful to humanity or other inhabitants on the planet. Some radicals are violent. The most famous and most effective radicals were nonviolent. I believe many people are born radicals. They are the men, women, and children who refuse to bend to the will of nature or suffer the indignity of physical or mental abuse and demand just retribution. A radical is anyone who will courageously fight back against anyone or anything they determine is a wrong against them or others. As a radical, I weigh my options and interests and willingness before I take action. Will I go to the courts? Will I write letters to a company president, to a government, or to government officials? Will I storm the Capitol building? I am still trying to decide how radically radical I really am. I think I am like others, who are waiting for their soul's whisper to turn into a shout or a scream, until they can no longer sit still or remain silent as the scale of justice is breaking under the weight of injustice. If the injustice has a spring, or a pulley, or a rope, or a crank, exclusively for itself, then perhaps you may consider whether the remedy will not be worse than the evil. But if it is of such a nature that it requires you to be an agent or of injustice to another, then I say break the law. Let your life be counter-friction to stop the machine. What I have to do is to see at any rate that I do not lend myself to the wrong which I condemn. That was a quote by Henry David Thoreau from Civil Disobedience. And I'm going to end my show with that tonight, and hope that you buy the book, or you can get it at Amazon.com. Go to Naked at the Mic, M-I-C. Naked at the Mic, M-I-C. Okay, is how I spell mic there, the microphone. And The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril by Ellie Steele. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we don't have another show tomorrow. Tomorrow we're off again, but you can join us next Wednesday, and I hope you'll listen. I hope you tell your friends about this program, and I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. So, adios, and don't forget Naked at the Mic. That's Naked at the M-I-C mic, and check it out on Amazon.com. Thanks for listening. Good night.